begin the Technet and Limehawk. Technet number 1447 of the series that began in September of 1982. There are three guys that run this Technet. WS2N, Paul, is our space expert. John, KC2WGB, is our expert among the guys that send him emails, among other things. And I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick. Welcome to the what I think is one of the most educational, more one of the most beneficial hobbies you can possibly choose. That's an opinion. The clan gathers every Sunday night. We discuss our favorite hobby, our favorite subject, wireless techniques in general. We teach each other how it all works. The schools, in my opinion, do a fairly poor job of teaching wireless technology. You really want to know somebody, you want to find somebody who understands how a transmitter, a receiver, an antenna, and a transmission line works, you hire a ham radio operator. That's a guy who's had some significant number of years of apprenticeship, and the way you learn wireless technology is by way of an apprenticeship. The school just gives you some of the basic knowledge, very little of it to actually carry on the profession, so to speak, and by way of the apprenticeship. Whether you're lucky enough, as I was, to work for a company for 13 years where that kind of work was taking place, and I was taken under the wing of some very smart people who decided to show me how it all worked. And for instance, Hank Keane, W2CTK, one of the guys who invented strip line techniques, the guy who had the desk two desks away from mine in the sea of engineering desks at the company. Another guy was John Clark, the guy who invented the automatic noise figure indicator.
Repeater, timeout.
As I said, John Clark was the guy who invented the automatic noise figure indicator in the early 60s. And that turned into a very successful product. And there was quite a few other people like that. Henry Jasek, the guy who wrote the Jasek Antenna Engineering Handbook. I worked with him for a few years. So I had a very lucky position, as you can tell. And so when you hear the opinions that John, Paul, and I express, it's not because we're so so high in IQ or whatever. It's just because we were lucky to be in the right place at the right time where people were doing that kind of work. We also had a strong interest in it so that if somebody three desks away started talking about an antenna, my ears would perk up and I'd start listening. So it's a good hobby to make an investment in from my point of view. Spending some time with it, and what better hobby is there where almost everybody you talk to has got a similar background, so to speak. He has gone through the process of getting a license, he's put himself a transmitter, receiver, an antenna, and he's set them up, and now he's talking to people with it, and you start comparing notes. I'm using this kind of an antenna, I'm using that kind of a transmitter, and I'm getting these kind of results. I made this kind of a change, and the results got that much better. Let me drop. So you get the idea. All right, the way you have the TechNet works is that for the first hour, John and I try to handle all the questions in a brief manner. In other words, the people who sign in first, we make a virtual promise that you shouldn't have to wait more than an hour to get at least a brief answer to your question. And if your particular subject requires a deeper investigation, that takes place in the later hours of the TechNet. The TechNet usually lasts from 8 o'clock to midnight because these guys have got that much enthusiasm. The total number of hours of the TechNet over the 30 and a half years that it has existed, believe it or not, is greater than the total number of hours that Johnny Carson spent in his 30 years on Channel 4 television locally. It's kind of amazing to me that it's lasted that long. It all began in a mysterious process back in September of 1982. I won't go into that one right now. So during the first hour, we briefly discussed each of the questions that are given to us. John then follows with the mailbag, where people who don't yet have their ham license or not yet properly equipped to get to us, because this is a live question and answer on the spot. Let me drop. John, Paul, and I are not offering a written consulting service during the rest of the week. It's an on-the-air, live question and answer period. So for those who are not equipped that way or don't yet have their ham license, they send John an email, a snail mail, or any other method of communication, Horse and Pony, the Pony Express, to give him a question, and some of them are really good. You can tell these guys are really scientists. And that's another great point. From my point of view, a real good ham radio operator is a guy who sort of wants to be a scientist. He wants to know, how does that radio wave really propagate? How does that antenna really transmit those signals? How does the transmission line act in those crazy ways? And so the scientist that's trying to get out quite often shows up as ham radio. A person signs in because they've got a question or a comment by giving John, Paul, and Dick, give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes. So a typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2 RFN, Alan, and yes. And by the way, KC2 RFN is his real call letters, even though in the latest issue of the Limock log, he was called KC2 FRN. But it's the same guy. And he's the guy who nominated the Technical Net for the award that it got 2 years ago, the Technical Service Award of the IEEE, of the ARRL. Alrighty, so once again, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or comment. The fact that you're just listening is not required. A long list of people signing and saying, I'm listening. And for 30 years, we sort of believe that somebody is listening. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
WA2PJF, veto yes.
Never heard of you. I'm having fun with Zito. So Bay Shore is well represented. Who else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2DWLAE.
Okay, KD2 Delta Whiskey Lima. And you said AE. I'm not quite sure what that means. Mr. TWO, what is your handle, sir?
Extra. It's until I get the official thing on the U.S. And name is Dennis.
Very fine, Dennis. And glad you got your new license. All right, so we've got Vito and Dennis. Anyone else to sign in with a brief question from the beginning? Give me your call letters and name right now.
This is KC2 Queen Yankee Whiskey. Name is Joe, and No questions.
Nice phonetics, Joe, and thank you. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters right now.
WS2N, Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, John.
Enter XGN after Paul.
Okay, we got Paul, we got Wes. Vito? You're number one on the runway tonight. And I'm trying to remember the phonetics I thought of. Pilot of just fighters. Yeah. We are two pilots of just fighters. It would be a set of call letters, a set of phonetics you could use, Vito. So, what would you like to discuss tonight, Vito? And Vito, by the way, is the guy who really diligently takes the courses that are given by Home Depot, where they teach you the best way to use all of the products and how to create good safety. So from time to time, Vito gives us the benefit of that education. And that's one other thing I wanted to mention, that the TechNet tries to tap into that huge amount of brain power there is in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut area where this computer has coverage. So we certainly welcome whenever a particular subject is being discussed, particularly if any of us makes an error. Chime in and tell us the benefit of your particular knowledge on that subject. We try to tap into it that way. W2PJF to take it. K2LIW, you got it, Vito.
KHF Ferry. That's what I call him, NY2H.
NY2H on a 4HF Ferry. Hey, thank you. You got it, Vito.
Okay, Rich, excuse me, I can't stay on too long. I'll bring my daughter to the train station momentarily. But a quick question, if I may. I was reading about product detectors, and I'm guessing, I hope I read correctly, that is the circuitry that is normally found, for example, in a sideband receiver, like a Collins receiver that is designed for sideband, the S-Line series, for example, where you don't have to get involved with a BFO to copy a sideband signal. It does it automatically. Can you explain just what this circuitry does on these receivers? Go ahead.
That's a nice question, Vito. in the early days when you got yourself a fairly simple receiver that was built primarily for amplitude modulation, like you take, for instance, the Heathkit AR3, I think it was, my very first receiver way back in the 50s, and many of those other receivers, they did have something called a BFO. It was an oscillator at roughly 455 KC, the same frequency as the IF strip. You turned on that oscillator, and now any simple carrier coming through, ordinarily a dead carrier with no amplitude modulation on it, comes through the receiver, and during the time it's there, the receiver turns quiet. And the guy is turning on and off that carrier with Morse code, you get upside down Morse code. You get a noisy signal when the key is up, you get a quiet signal when the key is down, and that's the way an AM demodulator works. With this beat frequency oscillator, where you set it a little bit higher, a little bit lower than 455 KC, you get a tone out of that carrier. So now you really hear tones when the guy presses down the carrier, or presses down the key of the Morse code transmitter. That's the way a BFO-type receiver used to work. Let me drop. And now you had a problem. If you made the BFO too strong, it would capture the envelope detector at the end of the IF strip, and it would cut down the audio gain, so to speak. So you want to make sure that the BFO was just the right amplitude compared to the signal. And the proper use of a receiver with a BFO, you usually had to turn the RF gain down just right. So you had the right ratio, and what you were looking for is the signal, when the guy presses down the key, the signal coming into your IF strip had to be the exact same amplitude as the BFO. That would give you the strongest possible tone. As his signal got stronger, because you turned the RF gain up too high, or if the design of the receiver had a BFO that was too strong, you had a silencing effect. It would cut down the gain. So that's the way a beat frequency oscillator worked. It did the job, but it was kind of hokey, and it didn't do the job very well. Along came the thing called a product detector. What a product detector really is a doubly balanced mixer. A doubly balanced mixer, it's a circuit. Nowadays, you can easily pick them up in very in nice little packages. They got four diodes in there as a ring network. There's a little transformer coupling the input signal across two of the diodes on opposite ends of the four, or the opposite ends of the quad. You've got that's for the signal coming in. Your local oscillator comes in, comes across the other two diodes. In other words, 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock would be the signal input of the four diodes. 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock would be the local oscillator coming through. It's called a doubly balanced mixer because if you turned on nothing but the signal, nothing comes out of the IF port. If you turned on nothing but the local oscillator, nothing comes out of the IF port. It's only the product of the two. When you mix the two together, local oscillator plus the signal, you now get a signal, the product that comes out, the sum and dip repeater. Time out. What comes out is the sum and difference. So if in the IF strip, in the place where you normally would plug in the beat frequency oscillator, you plug in this thing called product detector, it really is a doubly balanced mixer because the beat frequency oscillator is the oscillator going in. That in itself gives you no output. The IF strip signal coming in, or the signal coming in because the guy pressed down the key, that signal coming into the doubly balanced mixer, the so-called product detector, would give you no output. But when the product of the two, when it multiplies one versus the other, it makes that beat note. So if, for instance, the signal coming in the IF strip is 455 KC, and your particular beat frequency oscillator, which they don't call it that in a product detector, but there is one there, if the beat frequency oscillator is set at 456 KC, the difference is 1 kilohertz. Out of that product detector, out of that doubly balanced mixer, comes the 1 kilohertz note, nice and pure, going into the audio circuitry. And the nice thing about a product detector is that it does a very good linear job. You don't have to be riding the RF gain control. You don't have to worry about the amplitude of the beat frequency oscillator. It's just a very nicely designed circuit. With modern-day technology, it's fairly simple. And you'd say to yourself, gee, why in the world didn't they do that earlier? So that's some of the information. And I know the first time you hear it, it doesn't all make sense as to how a doubly balanced mixer, how is it balanced for both the RF input and the LO input, thoroughly balanced and they don't create a response. And that doubly balanced mixer, by the way, used in another manner by which it can do pulse pulse generating. I used a doubly balanced mixer to make pulses of a quarter of a nanosecond at 10 gigahertz. That's another whole story. So once you learn how that circuit works, doubly balanced mixer or the thing called product detector, it's a good thing to study.
Repeater, time out.
It's a good thing to study and learn because it's a very valuable modern-day addition to good receiver technology. That's part of the story, Vito. I hope that helps a little bit. And if you got to come back and ask some more questions, you're allowed to do that. W-A-2-P-J-F. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, yes, P-J-F. K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Vito.
Okay, I understand. 90%. Okay. But all I want to know briefly is that these sideband receivers, they have product detectors in them. Is that what makes you able to copy the sideband without getting involved with the VFO as you would with an AM receiver?
John, glad you asked that additional question because the VFO and Morse code reception is the only thing that I discussed before. And that's a very small fraction of the story. In order to listen to a single sideband receiver, a signal, the beauty of a single sideband signal is that it has no local oscillator. It transmits nothing but the upper or lower RF sideband. And when you don't speak into the mic, nothing comes out. In order to demodulate a single sideband signal, you must re-plug in the local oscillator that was there originally in the transmitter, but the transmitter notched it out. So in order to make audio out of single sideband, you must plug the carrier back in. And so in the days of a beat frequency oscillator type receiver, you had to very carefully adjust the beat frequency oscillator so that it was on the exact same frequency in the IF strip as where the carrier of the single sideband signal would have been had it been transmitted. You've got to plug in the exact right frequency. And now, because you're trying to get linear amplitude demodulation of voice, you got to plug in just the right amplitude of VFO. So it takes careful tuning of the fine tuning of the receiver frequency. It takes careful tuning of the RF gain control in order not to create distortion under, in other words, the oscillator you're plugging back in, you don't want it to be too strong, you don't want it to be too weak. And so you had to ride these controls real carefully to get good, clean sideband reception in a receiver with a VFO. Now that you've got the thing called product detector, it doesn't give a darn about the amplitude of the signal. It doesn't give a darn about the amplitude of the VFO signal, as long as it's strong enough. And it doesn't give you any output until both are there at the same time. So it's a much easier receiver to tune. You don't have to worry about the RF repeater.
Time out.
You don't have to worry about the setting of the RF gain control. You don't have to worry about the amplitude of the VFO signal as long as it's strong enough. So it is re-plugging in the oscillator. So whether you're plugging in the oscillator with a VFO-like thing for sideband reception, or whether you're plugging in an oscillator a little bit off to one side to create a Morse code signal into a tone, it's the exact same process. But a product detector properly tuned and used gives you a much more linear and much more hi-fi sounding. There's a couple of websites, I can't think of the address of them right now. There's a whole group of people out there who are working on very high fidelity single sideband. You maybe didn't know it, but when you listen to a real good telephone circuit of, let me say, pick a number, 10 years ago, every one of those signals you heard on the telephone was a single sideband signal. Single sideband properly done with a good product detector and the right kind of audio circuits can have the highest fidelity in the world. The fact that we all have heard single sideband signals that sound kind of yucky because of the heavy speech processing and the narrow filtering and whatever of the typical receivers, don't blame sideband for the yucky sound you hear if you've got a high fidelity set of eardrums, if you know what I mean. It's just a matter of the way it was designed and used. So a good product detector is capable of all the fidelity in the world if the rest of the receiver is designed correctly. Glad you asked that additional question, Vito. W2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, Jim, we heard you as a late check-in. Was there another person that I heard on top of Jim? Go ahead. Was that?
Dick, it's K6DPZ with a comment about product detectors.
Okay, you've been using a lot of receivers with product detectors. Go right ahead, Hal, and tell us what you've experienced.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Out there.
Unfortunately, Hal, the machine timed out. We heard nothing but your last two words. Please repeat that last transmission. Wait for the four beeps and give us the whole last transmission again, Hal. K6 Delta Papa Zulu, K2RIW.
K2RIW and TechNet K6DPZ. What I was saying is a thermogrid converter can also be used as a product detector by the 6DE6. This is used in a lot of the earlier SSB transceivers where one part of it is the VFO oscillator, and the other part that's the mixer is the detector, and they work also very well. K6DPZ.
Now, you said that so fast, I missed it, Hal. You gave it a name. Go a little bit slower. The kind of receiver you're talking about that contains a product detector. Give me that name one more time, Hal.
A lot of the earlier SSB transceivers utilized a pentagrid converter, such as like a 6BE6 or a 6DA7, as a product detector. One section of it was the BFO, which was an oscillator, and then the other section was the mixing section, and they worked as a product detector for sideband, and they worked very well without overloading characteristics.
Now let me ask you a question on this one. In the case of a pentagrid converter, where some of the grids are handling the signal coming in, some of the grids are handling the peak frequency oscillator, and yes, the product of the two gives you the IM output. Okay, pentagrid. Okay, if the pentagrid converter was the very first mixer, See, in order for a real product detector, you want either one of the two input signals to have all by themselves no response at the output. In the case of a pentagrid converter, if I only plugged in the signal and not the BFO, I'm still operating a control grid in that tube, and the plate would be responding to it. So it doesn't have the purity of the doubly balanced mixer, the four-ring diode. I'm a little bit troubled as to how the pentagrid converter can act as a doubly balanced mixer. Give me a couple of words on that one, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the tech net.
K6DPZ, it's done at the 455, right at the detector area. Instead of going into the detector, it goes into the 6BE6. The output of 6BE6 has a low-pass filter, so only pass the audio product of both of the signals mixing. It's VFO and it's incoming IF signal at 455.
Give that man a cigar. Now I see it. You're teaching me a beauty there. I didn't realize that, yes, the output of that pentagrid converter doing the sideband demodulation has got a low-pass filter on the plate circuit. It's only looking for audio and will thoroughly reject the 455 KC of the signal and the approximately 455 KC of the local oscillator rejection, the BFO oscillator. So that filter function in the plate makes it act like a doubly balanced mixer. Well done. Okay, so as you can tell, in order to really get clean sideband reception, you want to make sure that either of the input signals, all by themselves, cannot create an output signal in that particular circuit. I'm calling it a doubly balanced mixer, and a pentagrid converter, or hexagrid converter, these beautiful things properly set up can do that. Maybe that makes it a little bit more clear, Vito. So B2PJM, guy with a good question, K2RIW in the tech net.
Okay, very good, Dick. So I'm very, very pleased, and also what Hal had to say, very nice, and it did make it pretty clear. I had an idea, but now I have a much, much better idea. Thank you so much. I'm going to sign, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity to be recognized. So K2RIW, thank you again, sir. WA2PJF is clear.
Hey, John, it sounds like we got a happy customer. We've got to send him a bill. I'm having some fun. Alrighty, Dennis is next. Kilo Delta 2, Delta Whiskey Lima, with I think a brand new upgraded license. And congratulations. And you're allowed to ask almost anything except those questions about blondes and brunettes. You've got it, Dennis. KD2 DWL, HRLIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick, and good evening to you and good evening to John. I just want to say something that's not said too often. I think you're really, you guys are two gems in ham that appear every week and answer questions on their own time, and I just think that you're doing a real service to ham. Let me get to the question. The question is, in your personal experience, what do you think the best dipole is? Is it a horizontal dipole? Is it a vertical dipole? Is it inverted B dipole? Is it a folded dipole? That's what I'm trying to get to. There's a lot of dipoles. They're a workhorse of hams. But one's got to be probably better than the other. What do you think in your experience, Dick?
Dick, isn't that a blonde or a redhead question? Yes, it is. Half of that answer, and John, you got it right. Would I be happier if I married a blonde, a brunette, a redhead, or a mixture? Which one is going to make me most happy? And it depends on what you favor. A really smart ham, Dennis, is going to have a horizontal, a vertical, and a slant 45 dipole on his property, because depending on the conditions, one of them at this particular day for that particular QSO is going to work better. Let me give you a couple of words as to what a dipole is. And by the way, whether or not you feed the dipole in a delta manner, a beta match, a delta match, a folded dipole, I'm trying to think of all the... gamma match. There's a zillion ways you can feed a dipole. And at first you're going to say one of those methods of feeding is going to work better than the other. Absolutely not. Let me give a couple of words on this. Assume now that I've got a completely perfect half-wave dipole. Electronically, it's exactly a half-wave long. I'm feeding it in the center. Because the dipole, on a good day, it's got something like 73 ohms of center impedance. And if it's exactly the right length, it's going to be a pure 73-ohm resistor as far as your transmitter is concerned. Like I said, dipole in free space. I'm feeding it. Let me drop a second. I do a little coughing. Assuming I'm feeding it with 73-ohm twin lead, or I'm feeding it with 73-ohm coax with a perfect balance at the center. So I'm doing a perfect feed. At one instant of time, on the first half cycle of the RF into my dipole, the right-hand side is positive, the left-hand side is negative. On the second half cycle, those two voltages are reversed. You could, if you want to, put an infinite sheet of metal right down the center of the dipole.
Repeat. Time out.
I'm going to have to remember this timing. You could, if you want to, put an infinite sheet of metal right down the center of the dipole at right angles to the wire. Because that is the neutral plane, at each instant of time, the right side's positive, the left side's negative, there's a neutral plane right in the center. You put an infinite sheet of metal there, it would make no difference in the impedance, the pattern, the gain, the side lobes. Nothing would change when you put that sheet of metal there. Once you realize you can do that with a dipole, you suddenly realize I can feed the sheet of metal in the right-hand side of the dipole and throw away the left-hand side. You do that, it's called a ground plane antenna. Take that whole circuit, rotate it 90 degrees so that the sheet of metal is parallel to the ground, and the half of the dipole, the quarter wave monopole, sticks up in the air. We call that a ground plane radio, a ground plane antenna, quarter wave ground plane. You'll notice that in order to duplicate the original conditions, you want that ground plane to be an infinite sheet. And we cheat. We make a whole bunch of quarter wavelength long radials, and sometimes we only put down a few of them. We want to put down enough of them so that the RF energy sinks as a sheet of metal there, where the spacing between the individual wires is so small compared to a wavelength that none of the RF energy can go through the wires and hit the ground. That's a ground plane radio. A quarter wave ground plane antenna. Let me drop. Many of us reading the advertisements are led to believe that a quarter wave ground plane radio antenna, ground plane antenna, is the best thing going. The advertisements show you this beautiful shiny thing with a bunch of loading coils and whatever on it if it's a multi-band antenna. And we go through a lot of rigmarole to build that antenna. If you took that vertical antenna, raised it above the ground, and made it a real half-wave dipole, that so-called counterpoise, that grounded infinite sheet of metal, the best way to get electronically that function is to put the other quarter wavelength of a radiator there, the other half of the dipole, if you know what I mean. When you do that, the vertical dipole is now higher in the air, the phase center is higher up, it's doing a better job of clearing the trees, the mountains, the nearby buildings, the water towers, and whatever, and you get a lot more performance. One of the antennas that's really unrecognized is a pure vertical antenna fed from the outer end. And now here's the next half of the story, and that is, you'd like to believe in the case of that real dipole in free space, let me drop. You'd like to believe that the energy coming down your 70-ohm transmission line hits that 70-ohm impedance dipole in free space. You'd like to believe that the energy travels down the right-hand side and the left-hand side of the dipole and jumps into space. Absolutely not. It doesn't do that. Radiation is hard. That signal that you're pumping into that dipole travels down the dipole. 90% of it is left when it gets to the end of the dipole. Output open circuited end, that 90% of the energy bounces back. And what you and I call resonance, making it the right length, means that that signal bouncing back and forth, and it's got to bounce back and forth roughly 20 times before it finally gets radiated into space. What you and I call resonance is choosing the right electrical length so that all those 20 bounces back and forth stay co-step, stay in phase with each other. That's what resonance really means. If the dipole is a little bit too long, they start coming back late. If it's a little bit too short, they start coming back early to be in step with the new energy coming out of the transmission line going to the dipole. So once you realize a dipole has got a Q of 10 or 20, that means the signal has to bounce back and forth 10 or 20 times where it finally gets radiated. You suddenly realize that you think you've got a dipole. It really is a flywheel. You're putting energy into a flywheel. Once you realize that, you realize that in a real flywheel, like say for instance the main drive wheel on a locomotive, let me drop. You're putting energy into that wheel, and you don't have to put it in at any one particular spot. You can make the push rod be connected to the flywheel to very close to the center, the pivot, the axle, so to speak, or you can push the push rod way out to the perimeter. You'll get a different impedance when you do that. But in either case, you're putting energy into a flywheel, and it takes a number of cycles to do it. Not too different from using your finger to push your daughter on a swing. If it's a very efficient swing, and as long as you're pushing her in a co-phase manner, in other words, each time she's moving forward and comes to the bottom, is when you apply the push, and all of that energy builds up, and eventually she's got a great big deflection on the swing, even though you're putting in very small amounts of energy on each individual cycle. A dipole is like that. It's a flywheel. So whether you load the energy into that flywheel by way of a gamma match, beta match, delta match, folded dipole, or whatever, minor detail, doesn't make any difference to the pattern, the efficiency, or whatever. If you have any question about the efficiency of your dipole, or any other kind of transmitting circuit, if you have any question about its efficiency, you have the ability to make a beautiful calorimetry experiment, a conservation of energy experiment. If you've got any doubt, you turn on your transmitter, whether it's 10 watts or 100 watts, you run a key down for a couple of minutes, you turn off the transmitter, you run over there and touch everything on the antenna. If it's ice cold, it's not wasting any energy. If it's ice cold and you're putting 100 watts into it, it had to radiate 100 watts into space, or it would have gotten hot. There's only three ways that an antenna can handle the RF energy you put into it. It radiates it into space. You hope it does that one. It reflects it back to the transmitter. You can measure standing wave ratio, and you can detect that one. Or it turns your valuable RF energy into heat, and you can measure that one with your hand by finding out if anything's getting hot. So now, should it be a vertical dipole, a horizontal dipole, a sloper, a slant 45? Yes. All of them do something good. And now, one other thing you want to know about, and that is that beautiful signal that you radiate with your horizontal dipole, and you think the guy in London you want to talk to is using a horizontal dipole, and he's going to get the strongest signal from you. Not necessarily. Let me drop. That signal is signal gets to London by making a couple of bounces off the ionosphere. We call them bounces. It's real complicated, a little more complicated process than that. But the ionosphere is a bunch of charged particles that are really a plasma. Whenever you mix plasma and magnetic field, you will experience Faraday rotation. That signal you launched horizontal from Long Island gets into that plasma of the ionosphere, and it rotates. It rotates some number of times on each individual bounce off the ionosphere. By the time it gets to London, it might be a vertical signal. It might be a slant 45 polarization signal by the time it gets there. Depending on the state of the ionosphere today, if you launch this a vertical signal, even though he's got a horizontal dipole, that may give him the stronger signal. You can see that there's a great advantage of having various dipoles that you can flip between. And Faraday rotation does not obey reciprocity. That means the way you twist the signal when you go from east to west, and when the way you twist the signal when you go from west to east, is not the same. So even if you discover that your horizontal dipole gives him the strongest signal to his vertical dipole in London, you would assume, with good common sense, when he transmits back to you with his vertical dipole, you're going to get the strongest signal here with horizontal. Not necessarily. A particular state of the ionosphere could be that you transmit horizontal, he listens vertical, strongest. He transmits vertical, and you should now listen vertical when he's transmitting to get the strongest signal. Opposite of common sense. So if you've got all three kinds, and you've got a switch where you can flip between them, you're going to get the most bang for the dollar, if you know what I mean. The wire that we put into dipoles is fairly inexpensive, and they don't show up.
Repeater, time out.
We amateurs have tuned eyes. When we visit a ham or we drive up and down a neighborhood, we look for those pieces of wire like dipoles. We've got tuned eyes to look for that. The general public does not. They don't see wire. You can fill up the towers and the trees and the chimneys and whatever in your backyard with wire, and the majority of the public doesn't see it. They don't cost very much. They give you a lot of benefit, and people don't see it. Go for it. So put up all of them that you can. Use all the polarizations you've got. Use all the altitude you've got. They don't cost a lot, and you're going to get benefit out of it. As you can see, I've got a different way of looking at these. And one last point I want to make along these lines is that now that you realize it is a flywheel and you're putting resonant energy into that flywheel, whether you decide to feed it in the center, feed it 25% or up to one side, which is called the Carolina Windham, or feed it at the open end, that's your choice. But the most high-performing antenna anybody has ever had is the one that Mel K2KNB had in his front yard, a full half-wave vertical dipole fed from the bottom, fed from the open end. And the only disadvantage of doing that is you have to have an impedance step-up circuit. When you feed it from the outer end, you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. One inductor and one capacitor as an L network, properly chosen, and I can tell you how to choose them, it doesn't cost you very much, does that feeding, and now you've got an extremely simple circuit with extremely high performance, and you don't have to feed that transmission line all the way up on the tree, so to speak, in the middle of the dipole. Let me drop.
K2KEY was the call.
I should have realized that. I guess I called him something else. Yeah, Mel was K2KEY. He was only with us for quite a few years. He's now a silent T, and I miss him already. So that's some of the information on dipoles.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A dipole is the most basic of all antennas, extremely high in performance when properly used, and you got a zillion different ways you can feed it, and you can feed it at the outer end if you want to, and I recommend you put up horizontal, vertical, and slant 45, and now the slant 45, should you aim it to the north, the south, the east, or the west, if you've got the resources, I say do all of the above, Dennis. I bet that's a different answer than you expected. KD2, Delta Whiskey Lemur, I believe. K2LIW, you got it, Dennis.
Thank you.
makes sense because you've got different conditions, different things going on in the atmosphere, and it's going to be certain through and certain things that are going to be held back. So I appreciate your answer. I think it was a very exhaustive answer, and I thank you for being on the net every week.
Okay, Dennis. And I know we missed a few seconds of the beginning of your transmission, Dennis, but glad you appreciate it. Yeah, I know you got a little more answer than you needed, and I know that for some people it's a little bit disquieting to hear the repetitive story about the sheet of metal in the dipole and the flywheel action and what resonance is defined as. I'm willing to repeat that from time to time because an amazing number of people don't know it. The well-respected... textbooks do not say it. The teachers who teach electrical engineering, wireless electrical engineering, and wireless techniques, radio techniques, they don't teach it. And so many of these statements that I make, you never see them or never hear them in the classes. I'm amazed by that. The fact that every dipole, the energy has to bounce back and forth in order to radiate. When you're designing any antenna that's not a zillion wavelengths long, the zillion wavelength long antennas are either a rhombic or a beverage. But with those two antennas as an exception, every reasonable sized antenna, there's a half wave, one wave, one and a 5/8 wave long, those kind of antennas, in order to transmit, you resonate first, then it will radiate. Burn that into your brain. Extremely important statement. No book says it. I own about 35 books on antennas. I've taken a bunch of antenna courses. I've worked in the antenna engineering field for 30 years. Nobody has ever said those words. You resonate first, then it can radiate. Got to be a little bit careful what I mean by that now. Let me explain. And that is you resonate the radiating system. You're going to resonate the radiating system. By that I mean the thing that you call antenna, the thing that's connected to it that might be a balun or an impedance matching device, the transmission line that's connected to it, the antenna tuner that's in the shack, and the final stage of the transmitter, its tank network. That whole system is going to be resonated before you do any efficient radiating. You resonate the system first, then it can radiate. Yeah, in theory I can take a 50 ohm resistor as a dummy load, no resonance at all, and I've got long enough leads on it, the guy next door is going to hear the signal I'm putting into that dummy load, and I'm sort of radiating, but the signal is going to be 30, 40, 50 dB weaker than it would be from a real antenna. A real resonant antenna that doesn't get hot when you transmit into it, that once it hits resonance, it's going to give you a good impedance match to the transmitter, and the transmitter to the transmission line to antenna is going to have a good interface between the two. When that system, that radiating system, is resonated by ham radio standards, it will radiate. And the reason I'm going into those fine details is because you talk to an electromagnetic compatibility engineer. SCW, recognize, get you in a second. You talk to an electromagnetic compatibility engineer. His definition of radiation is very different than a ham radio operator. He wants all signals coming out of that shielded box to be more than 60 decibels suppressed. And if it's 59 dB suppressed and he's failing the specification, he says that it's radiating. Well, a minus 59 dB over isotropic, an antenna with a gain of minus 59 dB, no ham radio operator would call that an antenna. We don't call that radiation. They've got a slight repeater. Time out. They've got a slightly different definition of radiating than we do, but by ham radio standards, real radiation requires resonance. Mr. SCW, I think you wanted to make a comment or a question. Go right ahead, sir. K2RIW.
Thanks for letting me drop by. I'm having a little problem with a microphone. I just shot it.
Just, can you give me a quick check on this? Do you hear me all right with this mic? This is W2XCW, Jerry at the mic. Hey, Jerry at the mic.
You sound good. Tiny bit of noise in the background. It's not the strongest possible carrier. Let me drop. Tiny bit of noise in the background.
Have a, sorry to interrupt you, a Radio Shack handheld mic for the 252.
Okay, your Radio Shack mic with the 252 is sounding awfully good, Jerry. You got just the right amount of audio from what I can tell. You could use a little bit more antenna to give us a slightly stronger signal. Maybe that's the handy talky, but it sounds good. You got it working very well. So, Dennis, I hope that helps somewhat. As I said, you know, now know a little bit more about dipoles and some of the well-hidden secrets that's not in the good books and not in the real good classes. Another good thing that you can take a guy fresh out of school with a summa cum laude graduating recognition, if you know what I mean. He's a guy who's specializing in communications, and you ask him, as I've done on some of these guys I've interviewed, because they're applying for a job at the company I'm working at, you ask him, how many kinds of antennas do you think there are? You'd be amazed at the answers you hear. A guy's come up with, you know, 15, 20, 25 kinds of antennas. There are 5,000 kinds of antennas. You open up the fourth edition of Vlasic, Antenna Engineering Handbook. You look at those 40-some-odd chapters of just the general types of antennas and all of the subtypes. There's 5,000 kinds of antennas. You talk to somebody else who studied it real well. Maybe he thinks it's 3,940, and somebody else thinks it's 6,220. It's in that vicinity, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of things you could make into an antenna. You wouldn't believe all the slots in the sheet metal, the side view mirror and the rear view mirror and whatever, on a law enforcement vehicle, every one of those things that you look as an innocent looking metallic object, if you're smart enough, every one of them can be converted into an antenna. A dipole-like antenna, Dennis. KD2 at DWL for any other comments. K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to repeat what I had said in the beginning that was cut off. What I said was, so I need a blonde, a brunette, a redhead, and twins to get through the ham ear to compensate for what's happening in the atmosphere and the environment around me, which makes perfect sense, you know, to break through to make that contact. Over.
Y2H.
Lou recognized. Going to get to you next, Lou. Hey, Dennis. If you're a guy with enough resources so that you can be dating simultaneously a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead, and if you can get them with your gift of gab and into an agreement where they all agree to the other two in the existence in your life, if you've got the resources to do that, go for it. And yes, ham radio-wise, put on every one of those kinds of antennas. If you like horizontal dipoles, make sure you've got one east and west and one north and south. If you like slant 45 dipoles, put in slopers, put some of those up. So depending on Mother Nature's conditions and the guy you're talking to today and where he's located, some part of every one of those days during the year, one of those dipoles is going to work the best for you and have the ability to switch between them. By the way, many of the fades you get during a QSO with a DX station is because Mother Nature was changing the rotation, slowly changing from horizontal to vertical. Some of the QSB fades you hear are that. And if you can electronically switch between the two antennas, in many cases you can make the fades go away. Sometimes the fade is because the signal is skipping over you. Sometimes it's rotating in polarization. Lou, I think you said you were on a ferry, and you're sounding pretty good. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Lou.
Yep. Vito's Port Jefferson Ferry, PJF. Anyway, one of the antenna was the folded dipole, and you may just want to complete the whole picture with that. Now, from my understanding, it's like four times the impedance, input impedance, and I understand it's also a bit more broadband. You got a, I guess, a flat RSWR curve. So you just might want to round out his answer with that.
To Port Jefferson Ferry, to the 82 Port Jefferson Ferry. Hey, Vito, we got something else. If Vito was listening, we got something else you could use. It is phonetics for his call letters. You're absolutely right, Lou. As you make the dipole larger and larger in diameter, if you had the resources to make an 80-meter dipole out of pieces of copper tubing that are 6 inches in diameter, it would take a lot of resources to do that. And at lower frequencies, you can do it. You would have more bandwidth. That's part of the explanation of what's going on with the folded dipole. The folded dipole, you can start off with 300 ohm twin lead, make it a half wavelength long, short the two ends, somewhere in the middle, you cut one of the leads and you feed it with another piece of 300 ohm twin lead at right angles. That's a pretty darn good antenna. In fact, the very first television aerial I had in Farmingdale on Yoakum Avenue, 1947. Whenever you bought a television set in 1947, they came to the house, they delivered the set, they gave you a temporary antenna. They went to the upper room of the house on the second floor, and with string and tacks from the two opposite walls, they made a halfway dipole, which I think they tuned to channel 2, or maybe they tuned it to channel 5, I'm not sure which, out of a piece of 300 ohm twin lead. They made a halfway dipole, folded dipole, ran the twin lead down the stairs to the television set. That was our temporary aerial until they could come back the next afternoon and install the real antenna, the real aerial, on the chimney of the house. So halfway dipoles are very effective, very inexpensive, a little bit more bandwidth, and yes, they give you exactly a 4-to-1 impedance match if the radiating portion and the feeding portion are the same diameter. As you change the diameters of those two horizontal rods that are shorter at the end, you can get some slight different other impedances. Let me drop. And there's nothing magic about a folded dipole having only two horizontal rods to it, so to speak. You can make 2, 3, 4, or 5 horizontal rods, all shorted at the end, and one of them in the middle is being fed. When you do that, the impedance step up gets greater and greater. Instead of having a 4-to-1 impedance, you can have like a 6-to-1 impedance step up by having 3 rods instead of 2 rods, and feed the middle one, if you know what I mean. The other two are the radiating system. The way the RF acts, in my best guess on this one, Lou, is that the portion that you're not feeding, it thinks that is the antenna. The rest of the network, the thing that you've got to split in the middle and you're feeding, it thinks that's the feeding network, the impedance matching network. So, the dipole itself, you would think that to get various impedances of a dipole, that you must do various things with the way you feed it. Gamma match, hairpin match, beta match, delta match, folded dipole match, folded dipole with multiple lines to it. You think all of those are required to get the particular impedance of the dipole you need. Another one of the very best kept secrets is that you can get any impedance you want out of a simple halfway dipole fed in the center. Let me drop. If you go to the so-called Brown and Woodward curve, Brown and Woodward curves, plural, two of them, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, 1948, spent a good fraction of a year of their life making a whole bunch of measurements with a slotted line and various monopoles over a great big sheet of metal. In other words, they made a whole bunch of quarter-wave ground plane-like antennas, and they used every possible length, every possible diameter of the radiator, and they measured the impedance the hard way, the old-fashioned way, with a slotted line. A lot of mathematics. They probably put a man-year of work into that. Nowadays, that all could be done in 1 or 2 days with a good vector network analyzer, but all the possible impedances of dipole-like structures are in a set of curves, the Brown and Woodward curves. You go to any issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you go to Chapter 4, you'll find these Brown and Woodward curves. One curve is the resistive component, one curve is the reactive component for any length of monopole, and bear in mind that a monopole, a ground plane antenna, is really half of a dipole. A dipole is a pair of monopole antennas back-to-back. That's what a dipole is. So, with Whatever you read off the Brown and Woodward curve, you double it for your dipole. But here's the bottom line. You look at the resistive component. You realize that as you make the dipole too short, the resistive component goes down. As you make the dipole too long for halfway, so to speak, the resistive component goes up. So by doing nothing but adjusting the length of your dipole, you can make the resistive component of the pavement go from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive. Every value in between you can have by just choosing the length of a dipole. Of course, that sounds crazy the first time you hear it. Let me drop it. So if you wanted a dipole of 121.5 ohms of resistive component, instead of making the dipole electronically 180 degrees long, halfway, you're going to make it something like a 220 degrees long. The Brown and Woodward curve will tell you that. You make the dipole a little bit longer. Instead of it being 73 ohms, it'll be 121.4 ohms, if that's what you want, of resistive component. You can make the resistive component anything you want by doing nothing but adjusting the length. You look at the resistive curve, you'll find that. That's the good news. The bad news is that once you choose that particular length, it gives you the resistive component that you want. Almost always it's going to be a reactive component left over, inductive or capacitive reactive. If it's too short, it's capacitive. If it's a little bit too long, it's inductive. Once you know what's left over for that inductive reactance or capacitive reactance, you hang the opposite component in the center of the dipole to kill the reactance, and you're there. Let me give you another example. I want to make a dipole that's 20 ohms resistive component. I make it a little bit too short, so instead of being 73 ohms, it's 20 ohms. When a dipole is too short, that means that there's going to be a capacitor reactance left over. I hang the right size choke in the center to cancel the capacitor reactance, and now I'm back into resonance with whatever impedance I want. So to repeat it, the best kept secret in the world is you can get any impedance out of a dipole you want by doing nothing more than adjusting the length and putting one fixed reactor in the center, and you do the combination of those correctly, you can get any impedance you want out of a dipole. Once you realize that, not only is there nothing magic about what impedance the dipole is going to have if you're feeding it in the center, you can also feed it 25% off to one side, 50% off to one side, feed the outer end. The outer end, by the way, is going to be something in the order of 1,500 ohms. But you're feeding a flywheel. You're pumping energy into a flywheel. And for mechanical reasons, you can do it any way you want. And that's what Mel Schneider discovered, K2KEY, way back quite a few years ago. He hung this piece of green rubber-covered wire in his evergreen tree out in front of his house in the Manhattan Beach area of Brooklyn, and he fed it from the bottom, and it was one of the highest performance half-wave dipoles he ever had. Very unusual antenna. A simple stake in the ground with the counterpoise, that's where the shield of the transmission line went. The center conductor went to an LC network that fed that outer end of the dipole, and it got very high performance. The nice thing about a vertical dipole is that the ground reflection doesn't give you a phase inversion. Therefore, you tend to get a much lower angle of radiation. The signal much closer to the horizon gives you a much better glance and bounce off of the ionosphere, and you get a lot more DX out of it. So the reason why vertical dipoles are so unpopular is everybody goes through the training curve where all the books describing how to build an antenna, let me drop. They all give you this diagram of a completely flat-out horizontal dipole set in the center. That's the instruction manuals. That gets burned to our brain, and we think that's the only way to do it. We don't realize that there's nothing magic about it being purely horizontal, parallel to the ground. When you raise the center and it becomes an inverted V, whether you take the wires itself because your piece of property is not big enough, and you zigzag them back and forth, up and down, you put loading coils in the center, top hat capacitors at the end, you do all of that jazz to the dipole. You make an extremely minor variation.